Let's get back to the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com.
Part of what we do on the Baum Show each and every week is inform and ask some questions on your behalf along with your phone calls to make it a little bit brighter by the time you leave than you were when you came in. There's a tremendous difference between perception and reality in most of the topics we take up on this show. This is one of them as far as I'm concerned. There's a perception of evangelicals in this country. There's a reality. We'll look at some of the reality with Michael Lindsay, who's authored a terrific book on how evangelicals joined the American elite. He's a member of the faculty of Rice University in Texas, and he's our guest on the Dave Baum Show. When you talk about other religions, for example, Judaism, you talk about orthodoxy, conservative, reformed. You can see those real easy, Michael. Catholicism is easy, too. When you talk about evangelical, it's kind of like, who are they? Are they Baptists? Are they who? Well, I don't know. Who are they?
Well, this is the brilliance as well as the challenge of the evangelical movement. It's what we would call pan-denominational.
So
You've got Presbyterians, Methodists, Baptists, some Catholics, Lutherans. You've got a whole smattering of different religious traditions that fall under the evangelical.
So you can be a Missouri Synod Lutheran and an evangelical at the same time?
Yeah, you can be Presbyterian Church USA and be evangelical at the same time. That's the amazing thing about the movement is that it's very personal, and so it doesn't even rely upon your church affiliation. Now, some people use denominational labels as a way of saying, you know, these folks are evangelical, but that doesn't work very well because you have some Southern Baptist congregations where folks there say, I'm not evangelical, and then you have others that are. So you can't just impute denominational identity to evangelical faith, which is why I think that those kind of characteristics we talked about before the break are so important to having to understand who the evangelicals are and what it is that they're trying to do.
Perception versus reality. Most evangelicals are below the Mason-Dixon line, i.e. South, Southwest.
Yeah, that's a widespread perception, and there is some reality behind it. But the amazing thing is that things are changing so fast. I think, actually, New York City will probably become the next kind of global headquarters of evangelical Christianity in the next 20 years. Two things that's causing that. One is that there is this upsurge of highly educated, bright evangelical young people, many of whom went to Ivy League schools, who are working in the professional sector in Manhattan, who are very serious about their evangelical faith. There are more evangelicals on Harvard's campus today than there have been in 200 years, and I see no sign of that abating. So you've got a lot more of these kind of bright young professionals that are serious about their evangelism.
So what you're saying is that there's been a movement for however long of shedding the perception of the Appalachian-type evangelical.
Yeah. There was a piece in Washington Post back in 93 that described evangelicals as poor, uneducated, and easily led. Well, that wasn't true in 93, but it's most certainly not true today. I find evangelicals on Wall Street, at Harvard, in Hollywood, in the White House. I mean, they're really running very powerful institutions.
It's the cosmopolitan aspect that you're talking about here, isn't
it? Got it. That's the kind of type of evangelical faith that's really gained traction in the halls of power.
And less in your face than perhaps the more old-fashioned perception of evangelical.
Right. The old guard evangelical was much more focused on sort of, you know, what might be considered, you know, hitting somebody over the head with a Bible. They were very interested in sort of talking them through their faith and having a direct evangelistic conversation. Most of the leaders that I interviewed say, you know, that's possible, but I actually prefer a more modest way of going about it, which is to simply talk about your faith by signals. So instead of saying, you know, I'm a follower of Jesus, they say, I read the writings of C.S. Lewis, and I find him to be very profound influence on my own spiritual walk. So people who know who Lewis is realize, ah, oh, this is somebody who's one of us, but those who don't pick up on the signal.
Is this changing a culture or reshaping it? Let me give you an example of what I mean. Not too many years ago, NASCAR was something considered to be south of the Mason-Dixon line, strictly southern and maybe southwest. Now NASCAR may be even bigger north and northeast than anyone ever perceived. Would you say that the same type of, and I don't know what the marketing concept is here, but that the same type of dynamic has been used to change evangelicalism within the culture?
I think that, you know, there's some people who say that Christianity and culture have met in American culture and that the culture side is one, and so Christianity is losing its distinctiveness, at least among evangelicals. I don't find evidence of that. I find that it is changing, that commitment to local churches is declining, and yet people are finding other kind of spiritual communities through Bible studies or fellowship groups that are just as robust. I think that sort of the kind of national outgrowth of an evangelical orientation is certainly taking root. There have been evangelicals in New England all along, but they're growing by leaps and bounds these days.
Michael, is this a pushback to what has been the perception in the United States for some time that religion is not wanted here?
Well,
there are, you know, I mean, it's no secret in a lot of places that laws have been changed. The term, I think, that's been used for some time is being politically correct. However, would you say that this is a pushback, a strong pushback, to get back to religious roots to whatever degree?
I think there's certainly an element of that. You know, this is what has always made America distinctive from our European counterparts, is that there's a robust faith-based sector in American society, and it's not segmented off to some small cadre, but it's actually influential in all types of parts of American life. And I think that is what has been the case. But as you say, there has been a rising kind of secular tide, which really crested in the 1960s and early 70s. And we are seeing some pushback to that. The populist evangelicals that I mentioned, they are much more likely to see themselves sort of opposing secular humanism, as they might call it. But I don't find that same kind of evidence. I don't find that they're doing that to the same degree.
What kind of road do evangelicals take to get to God?
They believe in having that personal relationship with Jesus. And so personal conversion stories, becoming born again, is like the beginning part. And then they believe in reading the Bible regularly and having sort of an active prayer life, that those are spiritual disciplines that are prized within the evangelical tradition.
Okay, the cosmopolitans feel the same way?
They do.
Okay, but they're not as active church life-wise, as you pointed out.
That's right, they're not as active in church, so maybe they're members, but they don't show up every week, or maybe they show up every week, but they're not actually actively engaged in leadership roles.
What surprised you most in the few hundred interviews you did for this book about the many faces of the evangelical movement?
I think I was surprised to see how important evangelicalism is in so many different parts of American public life. I knew it was going to be important in politics, but it's a very robust part of Hollywood, for example.
Hollywood?
Yeah, there's now every major studio has a separate division that caters to the faith-based market. I was shocked by this.
And I don't example. Is there an example in your book about the...
Well, 20th Century Fox now has a separate division called Fox Faith, which aims to produce a couple of films a year that are at least have messages that resonate with the faith community, if it's not explicitly a movie about faith. And really, the tide turned in Hollywood after Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ. It became one of the top grossing films in U.S. history, and so Hollywood executives said, there's money to be made in this market, and we got to pay attention to it.
All gets back to follow the green, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. That's how Hollywood operates.
All right.
So you've got that kind of driving the element, and then it's followed a couple months later with the first installment of a 7-part series of books by C.S. Lewis, a Christian apologist and a professor of English at Oxford and Cambridge. And the amazing thing about this is that it's the Passion of the Christ audience meets Harry Potter, because you've got the faith element, but it's also a long series that's been a part of children's literature for many years. And the next installment, I think, comes out in May, called Prince Caspian.
What's the evangelical relationship, and I'm talking at the leadership level, obviously, relationship with Roman Catholicism, Judaism, Muslims? Is it good? Is it arm's length? What is it?
There are different segments, and I think it falls along that populist cosmopolitan divide I mentioned. Evangelicals have really extended olive branches to the Catholic tradition most readily, so much so that there are groups that get together between evangelicals and Catholics for prayer and Bible study in Washington, in Hollywood, on Harvard's campus. I mean, it's happening all over the place. So evangelicals and Catholics are probably the closest of those groups. I would say that there have been moments when evangelicals have worked really closely with Jewish leaders and with Muslim leaders, particularly on issues surrounding, let's say, public policy that they agree upon, such as the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998, which basically put religious freedom to be understood as a basic human right and made it a foundation of American foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have these different faith communities who don't always work together, came together around that particular topic. And you have those happen every couple of years. Relationships between evangelicals and Muslims are probably the most strained because both are evangelizing faiths and they evangelize to different ends.
And the youth of today, the ones who are coming into the evangelical movement, are they doing it because their parents did it, whether or not it was the cosmopolitan or the populist concept? Are they doing it because they feel, based upon your research, they feel that there isn't enough religion in today's society? What are their reasons for making this such a, well, frankly, such a fast-growing aspect of religious America?
I think that you do have evangelicals do a better job than other religious traditions of keeping their young within the fold. So evangelical young people going off to college are the least likely to give up their faith when they go to college. So you do have some of that element. You also have some demographic change. I mean, it's funny. Evangelicals have more babies than non-evangelicals. So they just by population growth have been growing over the last 20, 30 years. And you also have some very strategic kind of outreach initiatives. Evangelicals are evangelistic about their faith, and so they're constantly trying to reach other categories of people to see if they can't bring them into the evangelical fold.
Mm-hmm. So they will proselytize whenever they can.
Yeah, they will.
It's the whole purpose to bring people in who believe or think they believe as they do.
That's right.
And does this rub cosmopolitan evangelicals the wrong way?
They are probably the least likely to be overt in their evangelism, so that they are more interested in sort of building a long-term relationship there than going, let's say, door-to-door on outreach blitzes or whatever it might be called, which were much more common in the 50s, 60s, and 70s than they are today.
What's their feeling about social mores?
They're interested in sort of maintaining traditional, what you would expect, the traditional family values. They're concerned about abortion. They're concerned about same-sex marriage. I will say
drinking?
Sorry?
How about drinking?
They've given up on the drinking prohibition in many quarters. In fact, I was shocked.
Oh,
really? The number of people that I interviewed who, when I was interviewing, they were drinking wine or that the events were being housed at places where, there was an open bar. That was a real big change. Drinking and dancing used to be off-limits to evangelicals, and today they're joining
I'm
them.
Stunned. I have to share a brief story with you. You'll relate to this. A long time ago, I was in the service at Fort Hood, Texas, the 2nd Armored Division. There were a bunch of us who were single second lieutenants looking for dates. And we wound up with dates at Mary Hardin Baylor. You're familiar with the Mary Hardin Baylor. We had to go through a personality test in order to be put on a list to get dates at Mary Hardin Baylor, women we didn't know. To make a long story short, we showed up on Saturday night. There were four of us, four second lieutenants from Fort Hood, who had dates with women we didn't know. We didn't know anything about Mary Hardin Baylor other than it was part of Baylor University. you know where this is going. We meet the young women, very, very nice young ladies, and we go to a roadside tavern outside of Waco. And the first question was, what kind of beer would you like? And obviously the reaction is, we don't drink. Then one of the guys, and remember this is a few years ago, said, would you like a cigarette? And the lady said, we don't smoke. And then the music, somebody put some dimes, I think it was, or nickels in the jukebox. That's how long ago it was. And I remember asking my date, would you like to dance? and she said she didn't dance. And you're saying that this is changing?
Yeah, it's changed entirely.
Whoa.
It's a whole new evangelical world.
Whoa.
They're dancing at Baylor these days.
What's caused this? Because we were all from the Midwest or from the East then, and we were all kind of stunned because we didn't have a clue.
Yeah, I think that some of those kind of cultural elements of the evangelical movement, as it's grown more national and as it's sort of moved up into more powerful circles, it's picked up some of the habits of other folks. And so they're less divided from secular society in these kinds of ways.
Any other changes that are worth talking about in that sense?
No, I think that you've kind of hit the major things. Drinking, dancing, and smoking kind of covers it all. They still have the prohibition against premarital sex. They still believe in the fidelity in relationships. It's not to say that evangelicals don't have affairs, but that they're still a norm, that that's not the right thing, and that kids ought to wait until they get married before they have sex. They still do have sex, but it's not to the same degree that you see in wider society.
You know, much like any formal religion, I'd be interested in your comment on this. There's always been a sense, I think, among non-evangelicals, especially when the nons listen to the so-called religious leadership of the evangelical movement, that they're always preaching, basically, the Ten Commandments, and then occasionally some of these people who do the preaching wind up in deep doo-doo because they didn't practice what they preach. Thus, in the minds of many, I think, lessening the positive perception of evangelicals? I'd be interested in your comment on that.
Yeah, I got to say that, you know, I do, in the book I wrote, Faith in the Halls of Power, is not a defense of evangelicals, nor is it a polemic against them. It's designed to be a definitive account of what evangelicals have done with the power that they've had and how they got there. But one of the things while I was doing my research is that I was struck by how very often evangelicals don't live up to their ideals. So they say they want to live, you know, an upright life, and they miss the mark. And in some cases, you know, they get off scot-free, and in other cases, they get lambasted for it. I think it's entirely appropriate to hold people of faith accountable for what they believe to be sort of their faith conviction.
Well, I'm not setting them apart from anybody else, because Catholicism and priests and Judaism and rabbis have had enough problems of their own in recent times, but you do kind of get the sense, though, with some of the populist evangelicals that just the fact that they erred makes you kind of wonder what that's all about and what's behind what's behind door A and door B.
That's right. Well, it causes you to wonder how serious are you about your faith if you're at the same time preaching that you're in a, you know, having an affair or embezzling thousands of dollars. And there are some real crooks out in the evangelical world, and they ought to be held to account. Senator Grassley has launched an investigation, and I hope he gets them, because there are some folks who are really taking advantage of people who are giving money in good faith, and it's being used in really poor ways. That said, I think on the whole, I'd much rather have folks who have ideals, who want to sort of, you know, who say that they want to live up to high standards, than for folks to sort of fall down to the lowest common denominator.
We're going to continue our conversation with Michael Lindsay and take some calls at 1-888-463-6748 as we continue our conversation about Evangelical America on the Dave Baum Show. Stick around.